already talked about six, but let's just remember where we are in terms of goals through this whole process. We're trying to catabolize fuels, meaning break them down, for the purpose of releasing energy. Some of that, of course, will be lost as heat. There's nothing we can do about that ever. But some of that energy that's released, we're wanting to put into a different form eventually, namely ATP, right? Some of the energy that's in the fuel will be put in, stored temporarily as ATP, and that's really the goal of this whole process. And the whole process I'm talking about is the complete oxidation of fuel, or specifically the complete oxidation of glucose, since that's what the main fuel is that we're looking at. And so this is just part of the fuel, as we said. Dehydrogenase enzymes are so named because they catalyze the dehydrogenation of that fuel, which is also the oxidation of the fuel, right? If you pick off hydrogens, you're removing electrons, protons as well, but you're removing electrons, so that qualifies that as oxidation. And that's how we get the energy out of our fuels, by oxidizing them. And so what's left then is a spent fuel. That's what this piece represents. And if this is done not only for all the hydrogens, but if all of the carbons that are stuck together as the carbon skeleton are then dismantled, the only thing that you have left over eventually is CO2. So that's completely spent fuel. But the energy that's in that fuel needs to be captured in yet a different energy-carrying molecule before it can actually be put into ATP form. And that's where we ended last time. That's when I just got to mention NAD, which is a coenzyme, an energy-carrying coenzyme that I was likening to a taxi, right? And the NAD stands for nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. You can see its structure on slide 7. First of all, the name nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide tells you that it's a dinucleotide. But what is a dinucleotide? Two nucleotides hooked together, just like a disaccharide is two monosaccharides hooked together, right? And remember, think back to what I said, every nucleotide has to have as three parts in order to qualify as a nucleotide. It has to have a pentose sugar with two things connected to that sugar, right? On one part of the sugar, you have to have a nitrogenous base, and on a different part of that same pentose sugar, you have to have a phosphate. If you have all three of those, you have a nucleotide, which is why ATP is also a nucleotide, right? Well, this whole thing here is nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. But let's just look at the bottom part of it first. This green sugar is the pentose sugar. It is ribose, actually. The reason you know it's ribose and not deoxyribose is because it has this oxygen. Deoxyribose wouldn't have that oxygen. But that's ribose, the same sugar that's in RNA. Okay, and connected to it is a nitrogenous base. This nitrogenous base happens to be adenine. And you also have a phosphate connected to the sugar. So if this were just on its own, this would simply be one nucleotide. And specifically, since this is adenine, this nucleoside would be adenosine. And this is one phosphate stuck to it, so you would call that adenosine monophosphate, if it were by itself. Does that all make sense? Well, now consider this top one just by itself, not connected to the bottom one. This is also a nucleotide, except that this nitrogenous base is not one of the four main ones that we talked about that ribose usually connects to in RNA. This is a different nitrogenous base. Still has nitrogen in it, which is what makes it nitrogenous. But it's a different one called nicotinamide. Okay, so this by itself would be a nicotinamide nucleotide. And since you have both of them hooked together by their phosphates, you have a nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. Yeah. Yeah, yes. Chemically, that's why it's called that. Now, nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide, or NAD, is this taxi I keep talking about. It's a coenzyme, but it acts as a taxi because its job is to shuttle around, pick up one place and drop off another place, energy. But energy in the form of electrons from the fuel, from the glucose originally, right? And this is not the only one of these coenzymes we'll talk about, but this is the main one. Just like a taxi can exist in two forms, either empty with the driver's in it, but no passenger, or with a passenger, so can one of these coenzymes. They either have electron passengers or not. They're either carrying energy or they aren't. All right? So, since their passengers are electrons, when they are carrying them, what form are they in? These coenzymes. They're carrying around extra electrons. What would you say? How would you describe that chemically? It does give it negativity because of the charge. But what else? What's important about taking on extra electrons, chemically speaking? What does it qualify as? Yeah. It's reduction, exactly. So, the reduced form of this coenzyme is the taxi that's carrying energy, because the electrons represent energy that was in the fuel. Okay? The coenzyme becomes reduced by picking up the passengers, the electrons. And when it drops it off somewhere else, that's going to oxidize that coenzyme again, which is like getting rid of the passenger. And since the electrons are energy from the fuel, or represent energy from the fuel, that means the reduced form of the coenzyme is higher energy, carrying higher energy, than the oxidized form. Oxidized forms are empty taxis, reduced forms are passenger-filled taxis, and they are higher energy. Okay, so these coenzymes' job is to pick up energy in the form of electrons, drop it off somewhere else in the process. And just like ATP and ADP are higher energy and lower energy respectively, and we just flip back and forth between them because we'll add a phosphate to make ADP into ATP, and we'll strip one to use the energy to bring it back to ADP. It's always going back and forth. The coenzymes are always going back and forth between reduced form and oxidized form. So not the entire structure is repeated here on the right, even though it's there. Really what's shown here is the business end of it, which is the nicotinamide nitrogenous base. It's the nicotinamide that actually either becomes oxidized or reduced, depending on which way you're going. And so the two forms of NAD are NAD+, that's the oxidized form, lower energy form, and NADH, NH+. Now let me explain why this makes sense. When dehydrogenase enzymes pick hydrogen off of the fuel, they do so two hydrogens at a time. So if you pick off two hydrogen atoms, in terms of subatomic particles, what do you have? You have two atoms, but what do you have as subatomic particles? Two hydrogen atoms. Yes, but not only. Yes, but not only. Two protons and two electrons. You have four subatomic particles, right? Each hydrogen atom is a proton and an electron. So if you strip two hydrogen atoms off of the fuel, you have two electrons and two protons to work with. Well, notice that the oxidized, the empty taxi version of NAD is NAD+. It's already positively charged. So if you take one of those two electrons that you have and add it to it, it's just going to make it NAD. correct? Does that not make sense? Okay, well, tell me so, because this is the difficult part of the course. You still now have another electron plus two protons, right? If you take one that second electron and one of the protons, you have a hydrogen atom. And if you add that to nicotinamide, then it makes it NADH. Does that still make sense? And that gives you one more proton left over that you haven't dealt with. That's why the reduced form is not just NADH. It's NADH plus you have a proton by itself, which is the H+. And that's why we use this as the symbol for the reduced form of NAD. And that's carrying the energy that used to be in the fuel. It's carrying actually quite a bit of energy. A single NADH and H+ has more energy than an ATP molecule. And ATP are the goal. Making ATP, that's the goal, right? Well, every single NADH and H+ that gets produced and is therefore storing some of that energy that was in the fuel eventually will pay off in the form of multiple ATPs. So this is very valuable stuff. But that's what happened in the previous slide's reaction. NAD plus picks up those hydrogens and protons, those protons and electrons to become reduced into NADH and H+. Okay, the fuel itself is oxidized because it gets stripped of those electrons by taking away the hydrogen atoms. Now let's go to 8. Talked about this a little bit before. You could, if you wanted to, just directly combust a fuel like hydrogen. Here you have hydrogen, and this is a combustion because a fuel reacted with oxygen is a combustion reaction. And if that happens, if you actually put flame to hydrogen, this is why hydrogen can be used as a fuel in vehicles, you'll get a lot of heat and light because it's all one explosive event. And you'll decrease the G value because it's going to a much more stable configuration. That's what spontaneous processes do. They seek the more stable energetic configuration. And that's why this is a decrease in G to go from hydrogen and oxygen to water. All right. We do the same thing with the hydrogen that we get from our fuels, except we don't do it in one explosive step because that would kill our cells. It would not, and even if they survived, it wouldn't give us a chance to store that energy in useful form, which is ATP. It would be too quick to capture that energy. So instead, our combustion is really stepwise combustion rather than one step. That hydrogen that comes from the fuel, though, does get reacted with oxygen and it still eventually makes water. And like I said last time, if you do some process in a multiple steps, it doesn't matter to the delta G. If you have, you know, if you start with the same reactants and end with the same products, whatever that delta G is, you'll have that same delta G no matter how many intervening steps you have. So there's still the same amount of available energy, but we release it just a little bit at a time in a part of cellular respiration that we're going to get to that's called electron transport. That's where the big payoff is eventually. We'll have to talk about a lot of steps before then, but that's where it's a payoff in terms of phosphorylating ADP molecules into ATP molecules, which are now carrying the energy that was in the fuel. Okay? That's where we're headed. Let's then talk about slide 9. Go ahead.
I had a question on the last slide. What do you mean by 1 and 2?
That's just to make the stoichiometry correct. You could also just say 2H2 and 1O2. It would be the same ratio. But by doing it this way, a half of an O2 is just one oxygen atom, which is all that's in one water. So you could have been 2H2 and 1O2 become 2H2Os. Same thing. In slide 9, we're looking at the inside of a cell. The brown rectangle The brownness here represents the main interior of the cell, which is the liquid compartment inside a eukaryotic cell, which is the cytosol. Right? The liquid part of the cytoplasm is called the cytosol. And that's where this overall process that we're studying in this chapter, which is the complete oxidation of fuel, starts. Specifically in a biochemical pathway that's called glycolysis. That's why glycolysis, as the green box, is outside of the mitochondrion. It's inside the cell, but just in the main compartment, in the cytosol. Now, this overall process, well, let me start over. The book, I think, calls this chapter cellular respiration. That is only part of the process. Okay? And it's not the first part of the process, which is why I wish that the chapter were not called cellular respiration. The chapter is about more than just cellular respiration. It's about the entire process of burning your fuel for the purpose of extracting energy to put into ATP form. And that, as I keep saying, is called the complete oxidation of the fuel. And since we're studying it from the viewpoint of the main fuel, glucose, it's the complete oxidation of glucose that we're looking at in this whole chapter. And that has two major components to it. The first of which is glycolysis. That happens in the cytosol. That always happens first. Glycolysis is a word that means sugar splitting. Lysis is splitting. Glyco means sugar. So that's the first part of the process, but glycolysis is not actually part of cellular respiration. It comes before cellular respiration, and cellular respiration does not have to happen necessarily just because glycolysis is happening. More about that later. But that's the first part of, you know, when you start with the fuel, you have glucose. The first set of steps is glycolysis, and that happens out in the cytosol. The second major component of the complete oxidation of glucose is cellular respiration. And that occurs in the mitochondrion, assuming this is a eukaryotic cell that does it. Prokaryotes are able to do this without a mitochondrion, just by folding the one membrane they have. But we're studying this from the viewpoint of a eukaryotic cell, so it has a mitochondrion. Inside the mitochondrion is where cellular respiration takes place. And that's overall step two of the complete oxidation of glucose. Okay, everyone see where we are? Yeah, those are two major parts, but those are not single steps. Glycolysis itself is a 10-step process. So there are 10 steps that make up just the first part of the complete oxidation of glucose. And we call that first part glycolysis. But you don't see the details here. There are 10 individual reactions in there. So it's a biochemical pathway just by itself. All right? And we don't see the intermediate details here. But what glycolysis does is starts with a glucose, splits it, which is what the lysis is all about, into two molecules of pyruvate. And that you should recognize as catabolism, right? You're splitting a bigger thing into smaller things. Therefore, it should yield some energy, and therefore it should be exergonic, correct? Well, it is. That's the whole reason we're doing this. We use exergonic reactions to get energy out of our fuels, so that we can invest that energy in the form of ATP, which we can then use to power all the necessary endergonic things that the cell needs to do, which we have to force to happen by supplying that energy. Okay, so glycolysis itself releases some energy. And, of course, some of it's lost as heat, as always, but some of it gets captured in the form of ATP, as you see on the bottom here. Now, ATP is the goal overall. And so whenever you make ATP along this whole process, that's the end point. It doesn't need, nothing else needs to happen to it. It's our ultimate goal. So this ATP is ready to go, ready to be used for whatever endergonic process requires it. But notice that glycolysis also stores some of that energy that was in glucose originally in a different form besides ATP. It stores it in the form of NADH and H+, reduced coenzyme. You should keep track in your mind that these reduced coenzymes are really valuable, like I said before. They are carrying energy that used to be in the fuel. It's just that they are not the ultimate goal. They're not as versatile as ATP. So they're carrying the energy so that they can deliver that energy to a later part of the process so that eventually that energy gets invested in the form of ATP, the ultimate goal. Okay, and that's why this white arrow goes over to the mitochondria, because NADH and H+, the reduced coenzyme, is going to take that energy that it got from the fuel via glycolysis and deliver it to a later part of the process. So there's 10 steps here, glycolysis, out in the cytosol. Pyruvate molecules, two of them, get created in this process, and they are now what we have as fuel. Glucose no longer exists, right? Or that molecule of glucose no longer exists because we split it apart and modified it in glycolysis. But importantly, pyruvate is not completely spent fuel. I told you that CO2 is, right? Pyruvate is still valuable fuel. There's still a lot of energy left in it. And that's why glycolysis only partially gets at the energy that was originally in glucose. It's only partial oxidation of that fuel. There's still a lot left if we now use that pyruvate and process it as fuel. That's what cellular respiration is. Okay? So cellular respiration doesn't use glucose as fuel. It uses the output of glycolysis, which is pyruvate, as fuel. And to do that, of course, since cellular respiration, overall part two, happens in the mitochondrion, that means pyruvate needs to be transported into the mitochondrion to be used as fuel by cellular respiration. That's what this white arrow represents. Now, I said that cellular respiration is overall part two of the huge process, the complete oxidation of glucose. But just like overall part one, glycolysis has sub-steps, there are sub-parts of part two, which is cellular respiration. Cellular respiration has three major parts to it, only two of which are really pictured here well, but I'll give you the three in the order in which they occur. The first part of cellular respiration, which would be like part 2A, right? Because cellular respiration is really part two of complete oxidation. First part of cellular respiration is the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. And so this oxidative word tells you that more oxidation is going to take place. Whenever you have oxidation of fuel, you're extracting energy. But it's the oxidative carboxylation of pyruvate. Pyruvate is simply what the fuel is at this point, because we've already gone through glycolysis. It's the remaining fuel. Not as valuable as glucose, but we've already gotten some useful stuff out of glucose. Okay? We just need to get the rest of the energy out of pyruvate. So that's part one of cellular respiration. And that's represented simply by this white arrow, even though we don't see the details here yet. Part two of cellular respiration is the citric acid cycle, represented by this red square. That's one word for it, or one phrase, name for it. The citric acid cycle can also be called the tricarboxylic acid cycle. Or TCA cycle for short. This is what the biochemists would call it. It can also be called the Krebs cycle. You might have heard that phrase. They all refer to exactly the same thing. Krebs is just a dead person. So the most descriptive really is tricarboxylic acid cycle, or TCA cycle, but they're all three interchangeable: Krebs cycle, citric acid cycle, and tricarboxylic acid cycle. That's part two, or overall part, I mean part two of the overall second part of the whole process. It's part two of cellular respiration. And what that accomplishes is the finalization of the oxidation of the remaining fuel. The remaining fuel comes into the mitochondrion as pyruvate. By the time the tricarboxylic acid cycle is complete, there is no more useful fuel left, which means what must be the only thing left at that point? If there's no more useful fuel, if it's completely spent fuel that's the only thing left, what is that? What did I tell you last time and today is completely spent fuel? Right, carbon dioxide. So, the citric acid cycle, TCA cycle, completes the oxidation of the fuel, which means all the hydrogens get stripped off and the carbon skeleton, which was originally back in the glucose form, was six carbons big. That carbon skeleton has been completely dismantled by the time the TCA cycle is done, which means the only thing you have left over are six individual CO2s, okay, which came from the six carbon glucose molecule originally. And therefore, all of the fuel has been spent, because CO2 we can't get any more useful energy out of. But it's not the end of the process, because not all of the energy has been used yet. Some of that energy, though, notice in the TCA cycle, I mean, some of that energy released by completing that oxidation of the fuel in the TCA cycle goes into making more ATP. So that's why you have ATP also coming out of the bottom there. But importantly, the TCA cycle also stores some of that energy from that oxidation in the form of reduced coenzymes, more reduced coenzymes. So it makes more NADH and H+, just like glycolysis did. And remember, that stuff is more valuable than ATP in terms of individual particles. And it also makes a different coenzyme, FADH2, which is the reduced form. Okay, now, I'll talk about FAD as opposed to NAD in a little bit, but that's what the TCA cycle does. So the fuel now, which was originally glucose, is completely gone. Only CO2 is remaining. Some ATP has been produced, but most of the energy, some energy was lost as heat too. Most of the energy, though, is in the form of these reduced coenzymes, NADH and FADH2, that have been produced along the way. They're not what our goal is, right? They're carrying energy, but we want our energy to be in the form of ATP. That's why you need part three of cellular respiration, to deal with these energy-filled taxis and have the final payoff, which is to have those taxis drop their energy off and allow for a bunch more ATP molecules to be made. That final payoff phase, which is part three of cellular respiration, is called oxidative phosphorylation. All right? But oxidative phosphorylation, even though it's part three of cellular respiration, it's broken down into two parts. It has two components to it. And those are electron transport and chemiosmosis. That's where the energy that was being carried by NADH and FADH2 from these previous steps gets dropped off in the mitochondrion and allows for a phosphate to be added to an ADP to convert it into an ATP for many different ADPs. And that's why this bubble for ATP on the bottom is bigger than the other two. Because this final step is where most of the ATP gets produced. Far more than before. But that's using energy that was originally in glucose. Okay? Now, a third thing about this, an additional thing, is that the ATP that's produced by glycolysis, which is, all ATP is the same, that's the goal. But the ATP that gets produced by glycolysis and the ATP that gets produced by the tricarboxylic acid cycle, or citric acid cycle, gets produced in the same way via a process called substrate level phosphorylation. What is a substrate? Need to have these definitions down.
It's like the material used by the enzymes.
Yes, it's the reactant in a catalyzed reaction, and therefore it's the thing that binds to an enzyme and gets converted into something else, right? So substrate level phosphorylation refers to using an enzyme to transfer a phosphate that's on a substrate originally from that substrate to ADP. All right? But phosphorylation simply refers to adding a phosphate to something. What is it that we're phosphorylating?
ADP.
When you phosphorylate ADP, you are making ATP. And you're investing it, therefore, with greater energy. It's now storing energy that used to be in the fuel. When you spend that ATP, like we say, you're dephosphorylating it. That's what releases the energy again and drives that endergonic process. All right, so that's the map of where we are. Now let's look at the details. Slide 10, we can see a cartoon of substrate level phosphorylation. So this is how it happens for ATP production via glycolysis out in the cytosol, and also for the citric acid cycle, which is part 2 of cellular respiration. You have a substrate that is itself phosphorylated to begin with. It's carrying a phosphate. And since it's a substrate, that means it's going to bind to an enzyme. And when it does, ADP also is acting as a substrate, a second substrate. But the enzyme allows for the phosphate to be taken off of this original substrate and put onto ADP to make ATP, which is our goal, right? So that gets a different name from the ATP process, production process that's used in the final step, which was oxidative phosphorylation. That happens a little differently. But substrate level phosphorylation happens in two places in the overall process. Glycolysis, which is before cellular respiration, and also part 2 of cellular respiration, which is the citric acid cycle. Now let's look at glycolysis. Slide 11. I told you before that this is not a single reaction. It's a biochemical pathway. And specifically, it consists of 10 steps. We don't see all the detail here yet. We don't see all 10 steps. But in these three boxes in slide 11, we can see that the overall glycolytic pathway, which is just another name for glycolysis, consists of two major phases. A so-called energy investment phase, which happens first, followed by a so-called energy payoff phase. You can see this represented by the yellow arrows. The energy investment phase is called that because you have to actually supply energy for this part of glycolysis to happen. How would you describe that on energetic grounds? What kind of process? If you have to supply the energy. It is non-spontaneous, and what else? That's on the basis of whether or not it's going to happen. On the basis of energetics, it's endergonic. So the energy investment phase, in terms of goals, it's moving backwards, right? You're trying to make ATP as the ultimate goal of this whole big process. And in the energy investment phase, you actually have to spend ATP to make this happen. which is exactly the opposite of what you're trying, right? But just like the adage, it takes money to make money, it's worth doing because you're going to end up making more ATP than you spend causing it to happen. But these numbers are all per glucose. Okay? Now there's many, many glucose molecules that identically get split in glycolysis. But for every single glucose, it's going to take two ATPs to get it past the energy investment phase. But you have to get it past because only then can it go into the energy payoff phase. When it gets to the energy payoff phase, there's four ATPs that get formed, though, for every ATP that you, I mean, for every glucose that you started with. So you spend two to make four, and therefore you net two. That's why on the bottom, the net payoff is for two ATP per glucose. But that's not the only thing happening. In that process, you also use some of that energy that was in the fuel to reduce molecules of NAD+, the oxidized form, into the reduced form, NADH and H+. So that's right here. Okay? Using hydrogens that get stripped from the fuel in this glycolytic pathway. And so this means two NADHs and H+ per glucose molecule originally. And that's an important part of the overall net payoff, right? Because even though NADH is not the energy in the final desired form, it's actually carrying enough energy to make more than two ATPs. In fact, several ATPs. So its job is just not done. The ATP that gets produced, that's done. The NADH and H+ that gets produced, that needs to be to deliver its energy to the second major process, which is cellular respiration, for the purpose of ultimately making more ATP. And in terms of the fuel itself, you started out with one glucose. Glycolysis splits that. Now, glucose is a six-carbon sugar, right? It's a hexose. So there are six carbons in the skeleton. When you split a six carbon into two identical compounds, those two identical compounds must be trioses, right? That's what pyruvate is. It's a triose. It has three carbons in it with oxygen and hydrogen as well. And that's why it's still valuable fuel. You haven't completely stripped it of its valuable hydrogens. You haven't dehydrogenated the fuel entirely. You haven't oxidized it entirely. So glucose, for every glucose that enters glycolysis, you spit out two pyruvates, both of which will go to the mitochondrion. So everything we talk about happening in cellular respiration is going to happen twice for every glucose that we started with, because it's going to happen for each of the two pyruvates that glucose gets split into. All right, that's the balance sheet in a sense. Now let's look at the individual reactions. Slide 12. This isn't actually the entire pathway. I told you there are 10 reactions. But this is the first half. This is the so-called energy investment phase, which you can tell here, even if it weren't, but I didn't tell you that, you would tell that you need energy, because notice that ATP gets spent twice in this process. ATP gets converted into ADP, that's using its energy, and that allows for a modification of the fuel so that it can then go to the second part of glycolysis and pay off. Now, every one of these, as you would expect for a biochemical pathway, every one of these individual reactions is catalyzed by its own enzyme. And I don't want you to memorize all of these in this course, as you would in a biochemistry course, but I just want you to understand what's happening mostly. You're starting with a six-carbon sugar, and what's happening in this first part is that you're breaking it into two 3-carbon sugars that you see on the bottom here, which requires the investment of 2 ATPs for each of those glucoses. We're looking at it in terms of one glucose, so 2 ATPs are spent. But by the time you're done with this first part, which is the energy investment phase, you've already split the fuel. These steps before the split happens, which is at step 4 here, these steps really just rearrange the molecule. It's still a hexose. It's a different version of hexose, but it's still a 6-carbon compound along the way, just rearranged. And also phosphorylated. Okay, so the energy that comes from the ATP that's spent actually energizes the sugar by putting the phosphate onto the sugar. And that's what allows it to then be paid off in the second part. But notice the fork in the road down here at step 4. Step 1 to step 2 to step 3 to step 4, it all happens exactly the same way every time. But when you get to step 4, which is the intermediate fuel at this point, is fructose 1,6-bisphosphate, as you see, that then gets, which is a 6-carbon compound, it gets split into two 3-carbon compounds. But there's two possible 3-carbon compounds that can result. That's what this fork in the arrow represents. One of those is dihydroxyacetone phosphate, and the other is glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate. They're both 3-carbon compounds, and you don't really know which of those two you're going to produce. Okay, they're equally possible. The thing is, only one of those two, specifically G3P as it's nicknamed, or glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate, that's the only one of these two possibilities that can actually go on to the rest of glycolysis, the energy payoff phase. Dihydroxyacetone phosphate can't do that. Now, it would seem like if you happen to make dihydroxyacetone phosphate, it would be a waste. The reason it's not a waste, though, is because even if you do, in this splitting step, make some dihydroxyacetone phosphate, it quickly gets converted into the other one, which is glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate. And they have exactly the same chemical formula. They not only both have 3 carbons, they both have the same number of hydrogens and oxygens. So they have exactly the same chemical formula. What do we call those things that have the same chemical formula as each other? They are isomers of each other, which is why the enzyme responsible for converting dihydroxyacetone phosphate into its isomer, glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate, is called isomerase. So it doesn't matter whether this one on the left, which can't go on any farther, gets produced or not, because it all ends up being converted into G3P. Yeah?
Does anything get left out of GAP?
No, it doesn't get left out. No. It's just a rearrangement of all those molecules into a different skeleton.
Okay.
And it's G3P just like any other G3P is. Now, importantly, you started out with one glucose, 6-carbon, and now you have two G3Ps. Okay? So everything and that's the only thing that goes on to the rest of the glycolysis. So when we look at the rest of glycolysis, everything in it is going to happen twice, once for each of these two G3Ps. Yeah?
So what is the main purpose of making that the other one? Why do you have to have?
It's just that the cell doesn't have any choice. That's just the way the chemistry works. But it isomerizes it into the other so that it still works. And that's what we're seeing on close-up, just that bottom part. So that's the energy investment phase. We've already spent some ATP. We're going backwards, but it's worth it. 13 shows you the payoff, the energy payoff phase. And so we're starting with glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate, as I said, but remember, it's two different glyceraldehyde 3-phosphates because glucose splits into two. Okay. Then you go through several steps, the rest of the 10 steps. And you can see clearly that this is the energy payoff phase because instead of spending ATP, you're actually making some by phosphorylating ADP. And what method is used to make this ATP? Substrate level phosphorylation. Okay? That's what's happening here. And you have an ATP here, and further down the line you have an ATP. But it's listed as two ADPs getting converted into two ATP at each of these two steps, because it's really happening twice, right? You have two different G3Ps. That's why it's two at this step, one for each of the two molecules, and two more down here for a total of four, which means you've paid off your two that you spent, plus you earned two additional. Okay, but that's not the big payoff, really. That's valuable stuff. It's ready to go. That's the goal. Most of the energy, though, that hasn't been lost as heat and that hasn't been stored in ATP form is in the form of these NADHs and H pluses that get made as well. So glycolysis not only produces some ATP via substrate level phosphorylation, it also reduces NAD plus into NADH and H plus, which is now carrying energy that used to be originally in the glucose. Now the final step yields pyruvate, which, so the rest of this is just rearrangement, because you've already split it originally into 2-3 carbon. Well, those 3 carbon compounds just get rearranged. They stay as 3 carbon compounds, but they release energy along the way. Pyruvate is just another version of a 3 carbon compound. But it still is fuel. Still is fuel. It has carbon-hydrogen bonds that are valuable, right? So it can be spent as well. Glycolysis is done at this point, though. And since pyruvate still has usable energy in it, that's why you have this whole second part of the overall process to deal with that partially spent fuel, which is pyruvate. And that second part is cellular respiration, and that's what happens in the mitochondria. Let's look at that process now, slide 14. I wish they'd used different colors, but there's several yellows and oranges here, but this part with orange, darker orange, and then orange again, whatever these colors are, this represents the two membranes that enclose the mitochondrion. Remember that a mitochondrion is doubly membrane bounded. There's an outer membrane and an inner membrane. And so this darkest orange, that represents the intermembrane space, right? The compartment between the two membranes. The interior, fully inside the inner membrane, is called the mitochondrial matrix. And that's what this mustard color represents. Pyruvate is the output of glycolysis that we just looked at. You actually have two of these for every glucose that you've started with. This is just showing you one of the two. But you can see that it's a 3-carbon compound by looking at this structural formula. And notice that, I'm sorry, it should have been oxidative decarboxylation. So change that in your notes. It's not the first part of cellular respiration is the oxidative decarboxylation, not carboxylation, of pyruvate. Sorry about that. And that's what's shown here, by the way, the first step of cellular respiration. But by showing this carbon skeleton of pyruvate, the structural formula, and putting with a gray background this carbon and two oxygens, which is just part of the pyruvate, it shows you that that's a carboxyl group, right? Now, it doesn't have an OH only because at the pH that's normal in cells, that proton has been removed into solution. But at a different pH, it would still be on there, just like you learned the carboxyl group, right? C double bonded to an O, and then the same C also bonded to an OH. That's a carboxyl. In the process of... Well, for cellular respiration to happen, this fuel, pyruvate, needs to be taken into the mitochondrion through both membranes into the matrix. And in that process, it gets converted. It's no longer pyruvate after it enters, because it gets decarboxylated. So this gray region of the pyruvate, which is a carboxyl, gets removed. That's, by definition, decarboxylation. All right? And notice that it's oxidative decarboxylation, which means that process should yield some energy, right? Energy that was originally in this partially spent fuel pyruvate. Well, unlike the other steps, glycolysis before it, where energy got captured in the form of ATP, there is no ATP produced in this step. And you can see that also in the summary slide I showed you earlier. There's no ATP bubble below the first part of cellular respiration. But that doesn't mean no energy is released. I just told you it's oxidative, so there is energy that gets released. But it gets captured in the form of reduced coenzyme, NADH and H+, instead of NADH and H+, and ATP. It's just reduced coenzyme. Right? So no ATP produced here, but valuable stuff, NADH and H+, which will pay off eventually in terms of, in the form of many ATPs. In that process of decarboxylation, though, what we had as fuel, pyruvate, a 3-carbon fuel, is now a 2-carbon fuel, which is this, which is, if it were by itself, ignore this stuff squiggly line and above it, if it were just this 2-carbon fuel, that would be acetate or an acetyl group. Okay? But that acetyl group gets stuck on to another coenzyme. Remember I said that coenzymes pick things up and drop them off somewhere later? This is a different coenzyme called coenzyme A. That's what CoA stands for. And the S just shows you that part of its, the many atoms that make it up, is a sulfur. That's what really makes it work as a carrier. This coenzyme A, though, picks up what's left of the fuel, which is an acetyl group, a 2-carbon acetyl group. And when that gets hooked on to the coenzyme A, we then call that whole thing acetyl coenzyme A. Okay? Now that's what's left of the fuel after the first part of cellular respiration, which is the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. You have two acetyl coenzyme A's because this happens twice, once for each of the two pyruvates. And you've yielded, therefore, in terms of useful energy, two reduced NADHs and H+. Is that all clear? That's the first part of... the CO2 is the carboxyl group that gets removed, right? And CO2 is completely spent energy, right? So this is now worthless stuff in terms of using it for energy, which is why, as it accumulates, it will get put into the bloodstream, taken back to the lungs, and we'll exhale it. But that CO2 that we exhale, as I said earlier, was part of the food that we ate originally. It's part of the glucose that started this whole process. Okay? That's just one CO2. No, glycolysis didn't make any CO2, right? Because it didn't split the fuel finely enough. Here we have one CO2. That's why we are left with, and this happens twice, once for each of the two pyruvates. So that's why once you remove two of those from the six you started with, two carbons, one for each of the two CO2s, you have four left over. Two in each of two acetyl coenzyme A. Everyone good on all that? We're now at the end of part one of cellular respiration. And at this moment, we still have a little bit of fuel left because we haven't completed the dismantling of that carbon skeleton and the complete dehydrogenation of that fuel. So useful fuel that we have remaining are these two molecules of acetyl coenzyme A. We've also made some ATP along the way in glycolysis only in glycolysis at this point so far. And that was made via substrate level phosphorylation. We've also lost some energy that was in glucose as heat. Nothing we can do about that. But all the rest of the energy, besides those things I just mentioned, are now in the form of NADH and H+, that was produced in glycolysis and is produced here in the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. That's where most of the useful energy is, but that useful energy needs to be dropped off so that it can be put into the form of ATP. Okay, that's where we're heading for the part two and three of cellular respiration, how we deal with that. Well, part two, actually part one and part two are both shown in slide 15. Part one and part two of cellular respiration, that is. Part one, the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, which we just looked at in the previous slide, is represented in this slide by this first arrow at the top. So the pyruvate is simply represented by its carbons, three carbons. Right, that's what the three gray beads represent. One of those carbons gets stripped off in the form of carbon dioxide. Okay, that's the decarboxylation. And that yields some energy so that you can reduce NAD plus into NADH and H plus, storing that energy from pyruvate. But that leaves only the two carbon acetyl, which then gets picked up by coenzyme A to make acetyl coenzyme A. The job of coenzyme A is simply to pick up the two carbon acetyl and drop it off to the next step in cellular respiration, which is the bottom part of this, which is the citric acid cycle. Okay? Coenzyme A delivers acetyl to the citric acid cycle. And when it's carrying that acetyl, the whole thing is called acetyl coenzyme A. That's what you see right here. And you can see that it's only dropping it off because that's why CoA by itself is coming out. It's getting rid of its passenger, which is the two-carbon acetyl, that it has now delivered to the citric acid cycle, and it can go back and pick up more. So it's acting as a taxi just like NAD does. Only it's carrying fuel instead of electrons that came from that fuel. Okay, then we have the citric acid cycle. Step two, part two of cellular respiration. And the citric acid cycle, just like glycolysis, is a pathway just by itself. It's many reactions. But unlike glycolysis, which is a linear pathway, a beginning and an end, this one's a cycle. So if you were to think of it as a line, it would begin here and it would end at the same place as it begins. So the final product actually feeds the beginning of another turn around the cycle. Okay, now that can't happen unless you add something to the product as it's produced to make it go around again. And that thing that you add is the acetyl being carried by coenzyme A. And that's represented by these two gray dots. They enter the cycle at the so-called, you can think of it as a start-finish line, right? Like a racetrack. This is the start-finish line. That's where the acetyl gets added by coenzyme A. But coenzyme A stays out of the cycle. It just goes back and gets more acetyl. Yeah.
So as we're starting this finish line, figuratively,
yeah,
we have the two carbons that still need to be decarbonized, or
dismantled. Yeah, they still need to be oxidized, fully oxidized,
okay.
And dehydrogenated, which is the same thing here.
Okay.
And that's exactly what the citric acid cycle then does. With this little bit of remaining fuel, and we have two of them, remember, two acetyls, one from each of the two pyruvates, the citric acid cycle completes that oxidation and completes the dismantling of the carbon skeleton. So that by the time it's done, all you have left that was originally glucose is CO2. You already made some CO2 in the previous step, the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. Now you spit out two more CO2s. And that's the rest of it, right? It's two CO2s for each of the acetyls. But you had two of them, so there's four CO2s here and two in this earlier step, for a total of six CO2s, representing the six individual carbons that were originally in glucose. That is totally spent fuel, as I've said. So there's no more usable energy in this fuel anymore. The fuel is gone. But in the process, notice, some useful energy gets extracted. And that gets put into the form of even more NADH and H+. You see that right here. And in addition, a different kind of coenzyme, similar but different, FAD, gets gets reduced into FADH2. So I've told you about why, or the structure of and the naming of nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide, NAD. FAD is very similar, except instead of having nicotinamide, it has flavin as its other nitrogenous base. So FAD is short for flavin adenine dinucleotide. And it works exactly the same way. It's just a different chemical. The only difference other than the names is that, remember that the oxidized form of NAD is NAD plus, right? Which is why it takes an electron just to make it NAD, and then you have an electron and a proton making NADH, and you have a leftover proton, like I said. Well, the reduced form of flavin adenine dinucleotide is not positively charged. It's not FAD plus, it's just FAD. So, when you have those two hydrogens from the fuel, you can, which is two electrons and two protons, you can add all four of those particles to FAD. In other words, you can add two entire hydrogen atoms. And therefore, the oxidized form is FAD, and the reduced form is FADH2. There isn't any and H plus involved. It's just FADH2. So it's valuable stuff, just like NADH is valuable stuff, right? That's the energetic outputs of the citric acid cycle. There's also some ATP that gets made. And this ATP gets made the same way it got made in glycolysis, which is via substrate-level phosphorylation. And that's, of course, valuable stuff as well. That's the goal, after all. So it doesn't need to be modified. But the NADH and the FADH2 that get produced in the citric acid cycle have yet to pay off in terms of ATP. They're going to deliver that energy to the third part of cellular respiration for that payoff. The fuel output, well, it's not fuel anymore. It's just now all CO2. So the fuel is gone. In 16, we can see more detail of the individual steps of glycolysis. You can see that it's an 8 reaction pathway. But the 8th reaction feeds the start-finish line with an input from coenzyme A carrying the acetyl, and that starts it all over again. And notice, I'm not going to make you memorize all these intermediate names, but notice that the first one is citrate, which can also be called, depending on the pH, citric acid. And that's why it's called the citric acid cycle. Okay? Now the end point is oxaloacetate. And look at the structural formulas of these. Citrate, if you count them, is a 6-carbon compound. Oxaloacetate is a 4-carbon compound. Which makes sense since it's later, right, and you're trying to dismantle the carbon skeleton. But notice that what's happening here is that the 4-carbon oxaloacetate is what picks up the 2-carbon acetyl that coenzyme A drops off. And that transforms it into a 6-carbon citric acid or citrate molecule. So the overall goal is to break down the carbon skeleton, and actually this builds it up a little bit more, right? But then by going through the rest of the cycle, you can strip off one carbon at a time in the form of these two CO2s. So as long as you keep operating this, it really has the effect of completely dismantling what was originally glucose to begin with. Yeah.
How would it all get started? Very first, how does this get started?
Well, it's already going on for a long time before you're born, and in fact, before you exist as a human, because it's already occurring in the cells that are the gametes that need to combine before you are the zygote, which is the beginning of you. And that's been going on for billions of years, because in living cells, you know, a cell can't die and start living again. So even though we define the beginning of our life as the zygote stage, the cells are individually alive, and they've been continuing this process for billions of years, actually. If it stops, though, it's not going to just start over again. That's the thing. I don't want you to memorize all these details, like I said, but notice that there's three different places where NAD plus, the oxidized coenzyme, gets reduced into NADH and H plus. That's a big payoff. There's one place where FAD gets reduced into FADH2. That's another big payoff. They're carrying a hell of a lot of energy now. And there's also a payoff in energy terms in the form of ATP getting produced by substrate level phosphorylation. It's kind of a roundabout process depending on what species it is. For us, actually what we phosphorylate is GDP, making GTP. But then GTP drops its extra phosphate off to ADP to make ATP. So it ends up being ATP. It's produced either way. The fact that you have no fuel left, though, only CO2, is why I said earlier that the major function of the citric acid cycle is to complete the oxidation of the fuel. No fuel is left now. It doesn't mean no energy is left. Most of that energy is been captured in the form of NADH and FADH2, and a little bit has been captured in the form of ATP. Now we can go to the final part of cellular respiration, which is where the big payoff of ATP occurs. Do you remember what that third overall part is called? Third part of cellular respiration. It is called oxidative phosphorylation, which, notice, is a different kind of phosphorylation compared to substrate level phosphorylation. Okay, so it's, you end up making exactly the same stuff, ATP, but it happens in a different way. Now, in the graph that we see on slide 17, it's partially a graph and partially a diagram, but the box is the graph part of it, and so it has a y-axis, which, notice, is free energy, or G, which means for any X value, any part of the width of this, wherever, however high it is, that tells you how much G, free energy, is available. And this is why this complex of purple things is going downhill. Because as the things that are happening in this phase we're in now, which is oxidative phosphorylation, as that happens, free energy drops a little bit at a time. This is what I was talking about earlier when I compared putting flame to hydrogen all in one step versus what we do in our cells, which is release that energy a little bit at a time. So we're in the third part of cellular respiration, which overall is called oxidative phosphorylation. But remember, there's two parts to that. And those two parts are electron transport and chemiosmosis. Here we're looking at just the first of those two parts, electron transport. And so the purple things individually are proteins or protein complexes. And the protein complexes collectively in this arrangement make up what is called an electron transport chain. Now, you might have learned about these before, I don't know, but some books will call it the electron transport chain, as though there's only one. There's millions of these things in your body. They're all identical, but this is just one of them. All right? So an electron transport chain, as the name implies, is a chain of things, in this case proteins, that can transport electrons from one member of the chain to the next. And it's kind of an old-fashioned term now, but this is kind of like a bucket brigade. You know what I mean by a bucket brigade? You have a line of people, one that's picking up water from a well, for instance, and then you just pass it on to the next person, and so on, and the last person spills it on the fire or whatever you're trying to do. That's kind of what's happening here. Only instead of buckets of water, it's electrons that gets transported from one member of the chain to the next. Now, since it's electrons that get transported, chemically, what is happening to these members of the chain?
Electrons
since they are receiving electrons and then passing them on, what's happening to them? Redox, exactly. The electron transport chain is a chain of redox reactions, really, involving these protein complexes. So the first member of the chain, which is complex 1, Roman numeral 1 that you see here, receives its electrons from the taxis that are carrying these electrons that I keep talking about, which are the NADH and H+, that have been produced in three different places up to this point now. They were produced in glycolysis, they were produced in the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, and they were produced in the citric acid cycle. They're all carrying a hell of a lot of energy in the form of electrons that used to be in glucose originally and now need to be delivered to the electron transport chain. And specifically, NADH dumps its electron passengers off to the first complex, complex 1. Now, what does that do to NADH? By definition, what is it? Yes, it oxidizes NADH back into NAD+. It's dropping off its passenger. So it's now an empty taxi again, right? Now it can go pick up more electrons, just like a taxi is not done after it drops off its one passenger. Shift's not over, right? Can get another fare. What does this do to complex 1? It reduces it, but only temporarily, because complex 1, just like the first member of the bucket brigade, is not going to just hold on to that bucket. It's not going to hold on to the electrons. It's going to pass it on to the second member of the chain, which is going to re-oxidize complex 1, and it's going to reduce complex 2. Right? And then complex 2 is going to become reoxidized when it passes it on to complex 3, and so on. So it's a series of redox reactions, right? Because you're transferring electrons. But what the graph shows you is that every time these electrons get passed from one member of the chain to the next, the electrons end up being a little bit closer to an atomic nucleus. And remember, I was talking about this last time. The closer you are to a nucleus, the lower energy level you are. Right, the lowest energy level is right around the nucleus, then you go up from there. So when they get passed from one member to another, they end up getting a little closer and closer to whatever nucleus they're associated with. And that is why it is a decrease in G as you go through these transitions. That's where the energy comes from, by passing those electrons along the chain. This is an endergonic process because these electrons are attaining a lower energy configuration. All right? Now, this is also the stepwise way that we do it rather than doing it all explosively. Some of that energy is lost as heat, as always. But much of this energy actually can be used to do something. And that's because these protein complexes, number 1, 2, 3, and 4, actually not all four of them, sorry, 1, 3, and 4, three of the four complexes do double duty. They're not only members of the electron transport chain, but they also individually can function as pumps. Now, we've talked about pumps before. Those are active transporters, right? Often, the thing that powers a pump is ATP. Well, that would be stupid here, because the goal is to produce ATP, right? But if you're talking about a pump, you're talking about active transport, you have to supply energy. What is the source of energy that powers these pumps? It's the release of energy that I just described. As the electrons go to a lower and lower energy level, energy is released. And some of that energy goes into powering complexes 1, 3, and 4 as pumps. Now, what are they pumping? They're pumping protons or hydrogen ions, same thing. Okay, so complexes 1, 3, and 4 operate not only as members of the chain, but also as proton pumps. And the pumping of those protons that they accomplish is powered by the energy that's released by transferring the electrons down the chain. Which, remember, comes originally from glucose, because the electrons came from glucose, carried by NADH and FADH2. All right, so no more fuel is left, but the temporarily stored energy from that original fuel in the form of NADH and FADH2 is now paying off to power pumps to pump protons. No ATP has been produced yet, but keep that in mind because I have to stop there.